Good morning. I'm Judge Seaver. To my left is Judge Carlson. Judge Irwin was scheduled to be here this morning, but due to the death of the family, he will simply be participating on briefs on these cases. We have kind of a sparse crowd today, but if you follow the docket call, we can eliminate the cases and move them around. So it isn't like we intentionally scheduled just two cases. So with that, let's begin with In re Empress Wimby. Ms. Nelson, this is In re Empress Wimby. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. May it please the court, my name is Karen Nelson. I'm here representing Maria Lopez. I think in one of the recent Nebraska magazines that the Bar put out, there was a helpful suggestion written by one of the Supreme Court judges about what we do harm in oral arguments. And the court suggested that we put our best argument first. And I'm here to tell the court and submit to the court that I don't think the juvenile court should be quick, which I think is exactly the trap that Maria Lopez got caught in. Her daughter, Wendy L., or Wendy Leva, is 17 years old at the time of this trial. And in the previous fall, in the fall of, I think, September of 2008, Wendy goes to her mother and says, discloses sexual abuse on the part of the father. The mother, I think, initially didn't know what to do or think, but suggests to the daughter, we should call the police. There's some, the daughter says no. The daughter leaves, turns around, and does go to the police and call the police and calls her mother. The mother meets her at the police station. They take her to Project Turn and meet to be interviewed. The mother follows her there. The police officer, Nicholas Yanez, testifies that Maria Lopez was completely cooperative with the investigation and everything that happened. In fact, there, I think, was a one-party consent phone call where Maria Lopez contacts her husband and records the conversation and gets him to admit to the abuse. I think it would be very difficult for a woman who's been married for some period of time to her husband to be now looking at the fact her husband's in jail and that her daughter's been the victim of sexual abuse. But in this case, there's absolutely no evidence before this court that this mother failed to protect her daughter. And after the sexual abuse was disclosed, that she failed to take sufficient steps to protect her daughter in the future, or that her daughter would ever subjected to any kind of sexual abuse in the future, or was at risk for being subjected to sexual abuse. And while the mother did have a difficult time believing the daughter, there's no question, and even the daughter, Wendy Leva, testifies, my mom believed me. She never said she didn't believe me. She said she just had a hard time being caught in the middle of all of this. And I think that that shows some understanding and compassion by the daughter towards the mother. And I think that the court should try to have the same kind of understanding. I think that the court has done a very good job, and the cases that have been before it, to spell out for the trial courts what exactly needs to occur. And I think that there's a common sense approach to this that the court iterated, I think, in Rebecca. I think actually TMB, and it's cited in my brief on page 21. And I go through and list some of the cases that the courts come back and said clearly, this falls within the category of abuse or neglect. And some of them are pretty extreme. When you're hitting your kid or your child 40 to 60 times per week with a belt that leaves marks and bruises, that's really you know, it's clear that that's abuse and neglect. In this case, I don't think that there's ever any evidence of real abuse or neglect on the part of this mother towards this daughter. At most, you have a couple of people testifying that the mother went to visit the father in the jail. I believe that the state admits in its brief that it happened on numerous occasions. And there is no such evidence before the court in the record before it. There's also some evidence that the mother...
I'm sorry, no such evidence. What?
Numerous contacts of the mother went to the jail numerous times.
You say there's no evidence of that?
There's evidence... Oh, I'm sorry. There is evidence that she did go to the jail. I don't think it's clear how many times she goes to the jail. Jenna V. Nassau said, well, Mom said she had gone to the jail 2 or 3 times in the week. And I went back and asked, how many weeks was she doing that for? And Jenna V. Nassau said, I have no idea. And I said, so it could have been 1 week. And she said, yes. So Mom went to the jail, we know 2 or 3 times, but that's all we really know. We also know that the dad was calling home because the daughter was seen and on the caller ID, but we don't know if Mom was picking up the phone or what was happening with those things. But in any case, to expect a mother to discontinue contact with her husband once this happened, I think is completely unrealistic. I think that there would be legitimate reasons for her to be going to the jail. This is not an in re interest of Joshua M. case. I think from 1998 or 1999, there was a Supreme Court case where Wilma F. was and Thomas McWilliams, or Thomas M., was convicted of sexually abusing the kids, and the mother was sneaking the kids into the jail to see the man who perpetrated on them in violation of court order. This is not that kind of a case. This is a case where Mom went a couple of times to the jail, arguably to be talking about who do I pay the rent check to, or where's the money, you know, what do I need to do to continue running the household. And there was also, Mother had said, I think, to Jenna V. Nassau, that there were some questions of the father being deported. Again, I think that that would be some legal and legitimate reasons for her to go there. Instead of taking that seriously, Jenna V. Nassau comes back and says, well, in my opinion, that explanation is, quote, wishwash. And I didn't personally believe the mom. I don't think she believed her daughter, and because I don't think she believed her daughter, there's your specific risk. The specific risk is when he gets out of jail, she's going to invite the man back in, and that means the daughter's going to be subjected to more abuse. But in reality, I think the evidence before the court was Mom told everybody consistently, I do believe her. It's just very difficult for me because this is awkward. And I think that that's probably fair under the circumstances. I think it's also concerning that I think the only real evidence, and the state says in its brief, this is an emotional abuse case. And Wendy testified that she felt lonely and sad. I agree that that is an unfortunate series of events. But because children feel lonely and sad, I don't think it's a sufficient reason for the court to be assuming jurisdiction. There's lots of occasions where teenagers in particular feel lonely and sad. I'll reserve the rest of my remarks for another level.
Thank you.
Morning. Morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Sean Lockley, Deputy County Attorney. On behalf of the Douglas County Attorney's Office, I will be representing the state in this matter. Your Honor, succinctly put, in this case, the state was able to show, as preponderance of the evidence, that Wendy was subjected to emotional abuse on the part of her parent. Moreover, this was presented to a non-biased court, and it was presented in a reasonable time. as to the sufficiency of the evidence, State put forward evidence that while the mother may have repeatedly said that she believed her daughter, her conduct spoke much more loudly than her words. She continued to have a relationship. While it's not verified how often she went to visit her husband, it was on a number of occasions.
Isn't that an important fact?
It is an important fact. The specific amount of times wasn't clarified, but it was multiple times. The testimony was that she went to visit her husband at least multiple times in 1 week. It's not clear how many times over the course of a longer period of time, but it's also not specified that it was less than 1 week. The witness wasn't aware.
So when you assert that the state proved that Lee was subjected to emotional abuse, is that inference that we draw from her mother's continued contact with her father?
It's not just the continued contact with the father, but it includes the overt nature in which the mother had contact with the father. Wendy was aware that her mother was going to visit her father, and Wendy would invite the entire family to go visit the father. And there was phone contact, and even on one occasion, Wendy's mother expressed to Wendy that her father was very upset and was crying while in jail, and he wanted to come home. It's this repeated conduct of bringing to light what Wendy has done and the desire that the mother has to be with the father that demonstrates how the mother replaced her needs before Wendy's own emotional needs, which was to be supported after being subjected to the sexual abuse that she experienced in the hands of her father.
Please, you think the mere fact that arguably there was a more supportive position by, at least arguably, by the mother of the family, her husband, Wendy, is just that mere fact, is that sufficient enough for an adjudication in this matter? Do you think that tilts the scale if we leave it 51-49?
Yes, sir.
Because that's what seems to be here. It's a question of, is this mother more supportive of the father and of her husband, or is she more supportive of Wendy? And as your opposition seems to indicate, to some degree, it's a catch-22. I mean, she has a family, she being the mother, and she's trying to be, the head of a household now, and this was argued, and I suppose there is some legitimate reasons to be in contact with her husband. On the other side of the coin, the brief seemed to show a thread, certainly in your brief, that the whole family is not supportive of Wendy, including the mother, and in particular maybe the mother, thereby putting much pressure on Wendy and effectively putting her at risk. And I'm not a psychologist, but is that the genesis of what we're arguing about here? And if not, what is the key?
I think that certainly goes to the risk, but long term, and as this court has recognized, the state doesn't have to show that the child has been harmed, but is at risk of being harmed. The state did show that the child was emotionally harmed, but it also went forward and showed that this mother was either unwilling or unable to protect Wendy in the long term. Her interest was more focused towards her own needs. In the event that the father was released, it, based on her conduct, was likely that this father would be allowed back into Wendy's life.
Do we know the likelihood from this record that he was going to be released? I mean, he made these admissions as a practical matter. Was there any likelihood of that occurring to himself in this record?
Basically on the record, I don't think that is clear, but regardless of whether the father is released, there is still concern based on the mother's nature to put her personal needs in front of her daughter's, that in the event that another man came into her life that abused Wendy's. She would put, she being a mother, would put her own needs in front of Wendy's and support the individual that was subjecting Wendy to the abuse. And that is what the concern is, that the mother is unable or unwilling to protect Wendy when she needs to be protected. And her duties as a mother run more strongly to Wendy to guarantee her safety than it is to, you know, have a support her husband or a boyfriend that is, well, you know, emotionally connected to the mother. The duty that she owes to that individual is not equal to what she owes to her daughter.
Well, the evidence is that the mother participated in a phone call which provided the state with the father's submission and appeal to the mother. That evidence is supportive of the daughter.
Initially, and that's why the state ended up amending its petition, because the mother, subsequent to that act, continued to show that, well, she did the right thing at the time, was unable to appropriately proceed with that relationship.
So the state's position then would, in effect, have this mother who has three children with this man.
Yes.
Been married to him for 15 years or so. She cannot have any contact with him, regardless of what the nature of that contact is.
It's not a no contact, it's the overt nature in which she had the contact. It was very clear to
the state's position that she has to sneak around and go see him, perhaps to talk about finances, or even now with these two boys.
Not sneak around, but in the interest of appearing supportive to her daughter, not bringing back messages that the father is very upset, that he's crying, that he's in jail. Wendy doesn't need to know that. And when Wendy sees her mother constantly going to visit, when she's aware that mom is taking phone calls, or mom is continuing a relationship with the paternal side of the family, where the paternal side of the family is completely supportive of the father, believe Wendy is lying, and have an adverse relationship with Wendy. All of those in total amount to the emotional neglect that Wendy's mother caused towards Wendy. It's not one particular act that the state decided to go forward on. It's the totality of the ongoing, overt nature of the contact that Wendy's mother had with her husband, who did sexually abuse Wendy. And Wendy stated that it made her feel sad and alone, unsupported by her mother. And that is the foundation of the state's position that Wendy was subjected to emotional neglect by her mother. As to the impartiality that was alleged by the appellant, State v. Richter indicates that there is a strong presumption of impartiality on the part of the court, and the appellant goes on to rely on a case, Gibilesco v. Gibilesco, it's a divorce and custody case, where there is a very overt act of bias on the part of the judge. The judge addresses an issue in that case and offers a remedy that was completely unaddressed by either party in that case.
Counsel, I know it would be in the record, but did the trial court articulate specifically the reasons that she felt to justify this adjudication?
Not that I am presently aware of, as if I understand you correctly, it's...
Well, I understand the judge. My question is simply, does the order say, or did she indicate, the trial judge indicated in the record orally, why she specifically felt that an adjudication was justified in this case? Department of Justice that was sent to the board after listening to the evidence?
On the record, I don't believe so. As to the specific order, I can't say for sure.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, board.
Ms. Nelson, there's some time left.
Yes, she has a minute 46.
Right.
May it please support. In this case, the evidence of risk of harm to the minor child is very scant indeed. It was from Susan Coffey, who got a lot of the information from a translator who, it's the mother's position, isn't qualified. And the mother, and Susan Coffey was testifying, well, the child's perception and thinking is distorted, and because of her distorted thinking, this is might be how she was feeling. And during that testimony, Judge Cirkovich, who I like and respect very much, comes in and says, no, I'm not, and it starts asking questions. And when the therapist tries answering and explaining about the child's thinking process and why it's her opinion that there might be some issues here, the court cuts off the witness. And this is not an example of just trying to clarify and get a better understanding. The court comes in and says, no, not that. This isn't the question I'm asking. I'm asking something else. I think that's probably okay. But it goes on, and the witness then again answers the question in the same way, and the court stops and says, no, no, not to the child's perception, not to her, not to her. And so the witness again tries to come back and answer, and the judge says, no, wait a minute. I'm not angry here. I'm just really frustrated. And I guess there's many ways of reading that, but my interpretation of reading that is the witness, you're not giving the right answer, and you need to give me the right answer. And I... Okay.
Did you make any objection to the court's questioning?
I did not.
That problem with respect to this assignment area?
I think it's plain error. I think given the fact that this is in the middle of the trial, there was no way to file a pre-trial motion to disqualify because it's not until during the trial that the judge says, well, I consider these two allegations to be the same. And, State, I'm going to let you ask questions about what happened on December 7th, 2009, but, Counsel for Mom, you're limited to May 21st, 2004, and as it's going on, I guess that you start wondering, and as a counsel, you start thinking, okay, if I raise this, is it going to be heard and received, any chance of being received favorably by the court in light of the circumstances that's going on? I think it is plain error.
Obviously, you... very familiar with this record, and the same question I asked opposing counsel is, did the trial judge, in light of what we're just talking about, ever articulate specifically, either in her order or orally, what her reasons were specifically for your communication?
The court did not. I think at the conclusion of the evidence, the court made a verbal finding on the record that the allegations are true,
sure.
And then simply issued an order saying that the allegations were true by the proponents.
But there no was definitive statement about the evidence as to why she wrote.
She did not. The court did not.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. The case is submitted.